Welcome to Ukraine and Beyond and to my collaboration history series, Ukraine History in the Making. I'm your host, Emil, and over the next 4 months, Yevgenia Berutova.
History is one of the maybe most interesting subjects in the school curriculum.
Olena Dudko.
Without knowing your past, you cannot build the future.
Elisabeth Holvas.
I think that it is of the urgent importance to the world hear us and the world hear how devastating is the Putin's war.
And I will present the history of Ukraine as it was, as it is, and as it hopefully will be. Now let's get to the episode. Enjoy. Welcome to the second episode of Ukraine History in the Making. Today it is me again, and I'm talking with Elisabeth Polvas. So I guess you're like the second person from the team that is on. So do you want to say a few words about yourself and your background and so on?
Sure, of course. My name is Elisabeth Polvas. I'm a Master of Social Communications and Regional Studies with a special interest in the mass media manipulation and combating it, of course, as well as combating propaganda. My story started way before the war came to our land, but now it's of a crucial importance that we talk about history, not to let anyone distort our reality. And it's of crucial importance to study and learn the lessons from the past, reflect on it, and not getting back into traps that we've been in.
And the last time we talked about the period in what is now Ukraine in ancient times, so that was more like very old civilizations. Can you say a bit about what your subject is today? Like, which period is it that you are presenting?
Of course, yeah. We would be talking about Kiev and Rus mainly. The history of Kiev and Rus itself starts from about 9th century and goes all the way to 12th, to the end of the 12th century. However, we would also talk a bit about what happened between the two periods, starting from the 5th century.
And I'm glad you say that the last thing about also adding a bit of words about what goes in between the concrete periods that we are narrowing down on. Because, yeah, if you are like listening to this episode and also listen to the first episode as a listener, you will also now have an idea about the structure of the series, which is that we start as long back as what made sense, which was with the cultures before the formation of Kiev and Rus. And now we are slowly going forward, moving closer and closer to today. So yeah, this is like the second episode, and in the next episode it will then be me presenting the period approximately after Kiev and Rus finally like came to an end. And there will always be these short periods or longer periods sometimes also connecting the specific periods that we are talking about. But before you delve into the story of Kiev and Rus, I also put it in the plan that today we would start with some general thoughts about the project and about telling the story of Ukraine. So you already mentioned actually that you are interested in propaganda and so on, which is a huge part of this project. So can you maybe just share your thoughts, and I guess that will be a big part of it from your side?
Yeah, definitely. Nowadays, we see with our own eyes how the history is being manipulated to suit better the narratives of Russian propaganda. Again, it's very important to know the history, the world history, the history of your region, to reflect on what was done wrong and how it could be done better, and to learn the lessons that history providing us with.
Yeah, of course, I agree about that. And I want to mention specifically about the period that we will cover today is that I really think that the formation of Kievan Rus is really one of the points of the biggest like contestation about what is Ukrainian history. Not in the sense of that there is that much doubt about what happened and what the general story is. That's the one we will be telling today, of course. But there is a lot of attempts from people from, like mainly it's the Kremlin regime, of course, because they tell the story that fit their political needs. And right now that is, of course, to tell the story of Kievan Rus as if it was a part of what later became Russia, and therefore it somehow is the like origin of what later became Moscovy. And that is just the story that they are really trying to put into the narrative in the informational war about the history of Ukraine. So I think that is specifically like the misinformation propaganda perspective is specifically important today. I also think that here in the beginning, I could explain a bit about the title, maybe, which is the Ukraine history in the making. And the reason why it is like that is because that we wanted to put in the title something which refers to the fact that, like, maybe different from other countries, Ukraine is right now in a part of its history where the writing of history is especially active, which is what happens, I guess, when a country is at war. Then that means a lot in the place, in the place of history for that country. And that is just something that isn't really on the table for other European countries, at least not in the way that the general public conceives it. So Denmark, for example, our history has, in a broad light, it has stood still to a certain degree since the end of World War II, where our borders were really like cemented and so on. And yeah, Ukraine is just such a different case concerning that. Do you have some thoughts? Because you have also been in Ukraine and then outside Ukraine. And I get that sense talking with Ukrainians that their mind is like at a different space than like Europeans generally.
I would not agree with you here, actually. I mean, agree and disagree. Agree in the sense that, yeah, modern Ukrainians have this struggle of their identity, but I would like to be very specific here. Struggle of their identity nowadays, because we were under the influence of Russia before that Soviet Union, before that Russian Empire. And we talk about basically post-colonial period and transition from colonial identity to absolutely integral identity. However, Ukrainian history is rooted in the European history, and we come very close. And today, I guess we would hear to our own ears why these ties are so deep and so deeply rooted in our... I lost it.
Conscious. Okay. You could say conscious like that. That's always a good word. Yeah, when talking about these things, I think.
Yeah. Now we're conscious, sure.
And I get what you're saying. I think the point that I try to make and to convince you guys about as well is that in a hypothetical situation, let's say that Ukraine, which is what will happen and what we all believe will happen, wins the war and Russia is somehow knocked back, or like the regime of Putin is out of the picture, and that Russian imperialism experience a defeat resembling that of the Nazis or like Japan after World War II. I know history doesn't repeat itself, but something similar could happen. And I think maybe in that situation, Ukraine would then be in a position where it was free from the fear of having someone invading Ukraine from outside. And I think that's the kind of fear that isn't really there in general European conscious, like, for example, from Danish people. And I just think that that's where Ukraine separates itself in terms of looking at it in a broader historical period. So that, yeah, I think that is like why I really see this war as a continuation as well of Ukrainian history. That also makes it a part of European history, of course. Do you have anything to add here before moving on to today's subject?
I guess we can dive just deep into Kyiv and Rus history from now on.
Sure, let's not waste too much more time on like this. It's also a very abstract like conversation and discussion to have. So let's delve into the concrete, into the facts, and into the storytelling. So I guess the word is just yours here.
And that Ukraine is an ancient independent nation. Ukraine has a history of more than 1,000 years. Kyiv was a major metropolis and cultural center when Moscow was not even a village.
Yep. So we would start with the origins of Kyiv and Rus, where we will delve deep into the intricate tapestry of Ukrainian history. This segment, we embark on a journey to unveil the origins of Kyiv and Rus, separating facts from fiction and shedding light on the Scandinavian connection that led to the foundation of this remarkable civilization. So, the foundation of Kyiv and Rus, myth versus reality. Kyiv and Rus holds a pivotal place in the history of Eastern Europe. It's crucial to distinguish between the romanticized tales and the historical realities that shaped this early medieval state. Kyiv and Rus wasn't built in a day, nor was it solely the creation of a single tribe or ruler. It involves a complex interplay of migrations, alliances, and cultural exchanges. The most important here is the Varygian connection and the Scandinavian influence in early Rus. One of the most intriguing aspects of Kyiv and Rus is its Varygian connection, linking it to the Scandinavian world. Varygians, the Norse warriors and traders, ventured southwards seeking new opportunities and territories. These Norsemen, known for their immense powers and martial skills, played a significant role in the formation of early Rus. They were led by legendary figures like Rurik and established themselves as a rurals in the region, laying the groundwork for what would become Kyiv and Rus. And here we are getting to the moment of foundation of Kyiv, which is also covered in myths all the time. The foundation of Kyiv marked a significant milestone in the history of Kyiv and Rus. Legend has it that the city was founded by three brothers, Kish, Chek, and Horif, and their sister Libit. By the way, Libit is translated as a swan from Ukrainian language. Though historical accounts suggest a more complex process of settlement, strategically situated along the trade routes connecting the Baltic and Black Seas, Kyiv was founded in the year of 482 and became a bustling center of commerce and culture. Its geographical location on the banks of Dnipro River facilitated the trade with Byzantium, the Slavic world, and the Baltic regions. Here it's very important to stress the etymology of the term Rus, because that was the point of manipulation and disinformation for centuries with Russia. Rus itself has its roots in the Old Norse, and it means the man who rule, which makes a lot of sense because those Norsemen traveled throughout the river and rode a lot to get to the settlement named Kyiv. And it definitely has a Scandinavian origin. It's also important to note that Rus has no connection to modern Russia. a distinction often blurred by historical misconceptions and propaganda. In some Western regions, a modern term, Rusyn, is still in use and referred to local ethnical group in the Carpathian region. Again, no connection to Russia here.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess.
And so you have like, yeah, the listeners maybe should know that you have brought it, or you have split it into three segments, right? Or was it four segments?
Three segments.
Oh, three, right? Yeah, three segments, right? Yeah. So this was like the first one, which is like the formation of Kiev and Rus, like the background for it and the like establishment of it. And you talk about the term Rus. Can you elaborate a bit upon how this term Rus ended up playing this very distorted role, I guess you could say, in the overall story of Eastern Europe? Because anyone today would connect the term Rus with modern, like, Russian Federation.
Yeah, of course. You know, we talk about imperialism here again because each empire needs basis to be an empire. It needs mythology, it needs historical rooting, and that's what Russia did with Rus. Because as we know, the term Russia appears in history around the second part of 18th century. And before that, this territory was referred to as Moscovia, and people who lived there were referred to as Moskoviti. They basically chose the name Russia because of Kievan Rus, because they needed the background to validate their right to be an empire. Because Kievan Rus was not an empire, but it was a huge medieval state encompassing the territories, partial territories of modern Moldova, Ukraine, Romania, Slovakia, Belarus, and Russia, of course, as well, partly. So what is it? They stole the original name of Ukrainian lands to validate them being the successors of this great history, to validate their status as an empire. And if we look at the other examples, we will see some similarities in how empires are built and how empires are crystallized to be the power they are.
So what you're saying is that this, as a lot of things, I think, does, it has its roots in the late 18th century when Russia really first like conquered Ukraine and put it under like Russian imperial occupation that lasted for way too long, right up
more
until 1990.
Years.
Yeah, exactly, all the way up until 1991. So it was back when they conquered Ukraine, the lands of what is today Ukraine. When they conquered these lands, they then made up a story about their own origin as somehow being Russian, even though what they actually did was to conquer the ancient lands of what was in the beginning of, year 1000, when like Kievan Rus was really established. So then they laid claim to that history as being their origin story, and therefore they could then somehow legitimately claim all these countries. Yeah,
to validate the imperial status, they needed history to back it up, and they took the name and made them their own, even though, again, Rusyn is still the legit name of ethnical group which lives at the Zakarpattia region. Zakarpattia region being a region behind the Carpathian Mountains, so far from Russia and Ukraine.
It's just pretty telling that once again, even though we're talking about a period that goes so much a period that is so much earlier than today and than in the late 18th century, like, because we also had a very early period the last time, and also in the last episode, we saw examples of Russia claiming some sort of territorial ownership of ancient Ukraine, even though, yeah, as Jeff Genia said, the word, like, that Russia wasn't even, like, a thing back then. And in this case, neither was Muscovy, I guess, which was the principality that became Russia. Also, for me, of course, because we could obviously, I think, end up talking about Russian misinformation endlessly, because they distort every possible period of history. But for me, going back to the actual story about what is Kiev and Rus, for me, of course, it's very interesting that it was the Vikings, because that makes it so that in a certain way, it is also my ancestors that came to the lands of Ukraine and started
it
to establish these
ancestors. Yeah, here there is no historical or any other question. It's definitely
exactly, yeah.
Ancestors mixed with Slavic tribes that lived and inhabited those territories. And of course, as I mentioned before, the first like structure to Kiev and Rus was brought with Rurik, who was a Viking and who came from north seeking routes. Actually, the trade route was called from Varangians to Greece, to Greeks. That was the original. That's how we call it in Ukraine, and like we studied it all the time.
Can I ask like one question here? And then I think we should move on to segment two.
Of course.
But so your focus has been a lot on the like Scandinavian Viking influence, however you want to term it. But when they arrived in the land of Ukraine, were there any people already inhabiting these lands? And can you maybe talk a bit about how that whole connection then came into play between the Vikings and the local population?
Yeah, as I said before, this territory was initially inhabited by Slavic tribes, and Kiev was established in, again, 482. And in the year 882, the Rurik came, and it is basically called the takeover of Kiev. So he also took Kiev with tribes that were there, that lived there, inhabited the territory, and started this early medieval state. And that's where the real history of Kiev and Rus starts. Because before that, it was not a state. It was just tribes which lived together. There were quite a lot of people inhabiting the land, but still no state, no like rules,
laws,
or any kind of structure, organizational structure.
But I guess then this is a pretty good leeway then. Sorry, what did you say?
Oh yeah, I'm saying that Vikings actually brought, and Scandinavians, they brought this organizational structure, initial organizational structure to Kiev and Rus, because I will tell you about the period of Yaroslav Mudry, and we would see Yaroslav the Wise, and we will see how with time the national spark happened, and all the statesmen were taken by the local people, whether Scandinavian influence remained in the military field.
So. Yeah, and I also think that, talking about these things is probably a pretty good leeway then leading on to the second segment, which will be then, I guess, more focused also upon the like concrete formation of what we know as Kiev and Rus. So, yeah, I think I'll just let you further the like exploration of Kiev and Rus.
Yeah, the second segment, we focus on the cultural flourishing of Kiev and Rus and delve deep into the vibrant cultural background of Ukrainians, from economic prosperity to political intrigue and religious transformation. Join us as we uncover the Renaissance that shaped the heart of Eastern Europe. Weirdly enough, the times that are called dark times in European history are called the Golden Age of Kievan Rus. During the Golden Age of Kievan Rus, spanning from around the 10th to 12th centuries, the land of Rus experienced a period of unprecedented growth and prosperity. Under the rule of wise monarchs and visionary leaders, Kiev emerged as a beacon of civilization in Eastern Europe. Economic trade flourished along the Dnieper River, connecting the Baltic and Black Seas, while political stability paved the way for cultural exchange. It was a time of great achievement, governance, making Kiev a powerhouse. Very interesting part about legislation and the state organization, because at the heart of Kievan Rus' prosperity and stability laid its legal system, embodied in the codifications known as Pravda. Pravda is translated from Ukrainian as the truth. Among these, there were Ruska Pravda. Again, Ruska Pravda, nothing to do with Russia. Ruska means Ukraine.
Yes.
Basically, in this equation, Ruska will always mean Ukrainian. Nothing else. And Ruska Pravda is attributed to Prince Yaroslav the Wise, and it stands out as a monumental achievement in legal governance. This comprehensive legal code established a framework for justice and administration, ensuring order and fairness throughout the realm. The Pravda Yaroslava, which is a revised version of the Ruska Pravda, further refined legal procedures and codified punishments for various offenses. Additionally, there was Pravda Yaroslavichev, compliant during the reign of Yaroslav descendants, Yaroslavichev being the sons of Yaroslav. It continued the tradition of legal scholarship and governance. These legal codes not only provided a basis for resolving disputes and maintaining social order, but also reflected a sophistication and maturity of Kievan Rus' legal system. Through the Ruska Pravda, Pravda Yaroslava, and Pravda Yaroslavichev, Kievan Rus' demonstrated its commitment to the rule of law and laid the groundwork for future legal developments all over Eastern Europe. One of the key historical figures here, as I mentioned before, is King Yaroslav the Wise. King Yaroslav the Wise continued the legacy with strategic merging policy, earning him a title of Father-in-Law of Europe. Among his notable children, Princess Anna Yaroslavna, married to King Henry I of France, and solidified ties between Kiev and Rus in Western Europe. Anna was renowned for her wisdom and grace. She brought the very famous Reims Gospel with her to France. Reims Gospel is a precious manuscript that would play a significant role in French royal ceremonies. This gospel was used for the coronation of future kings of France and always symbolized the enduring bond between Kievan Rus and Western Christian world. And here we come to the news from President Macron, who recently became one of the loudest and most blunt supporters of Ukraine, telling his nation that it's not the Ukrainian war, it's the war between European way of being, Western way of being, about rule of law, democracy, and authoritarian Eastern regime of Russia. And now, when I think about it, I can trace back the long-lasting friendship that we have, and I'm more than sure that President Macron is well aware of who Anna Yaroslavna was and what role she played in French history, being the Queen of France. I would like to continue about Yaroslav's strategic marriage policy.
Okay, yeah, let's just take that then, and then I have a few questions after. But yeah, just continue with the strategic marriage policy.
If you have something to say about Macron and France, we can do it right now.
Yeah, I have maybe a few lines, because this is also a thing where you really have to be knowledgeable about the period and the specific actions that took place. But looking at it, dwelling into it, and reading about it, I just get the sense more and more that there was a French and Kievan Rus connection back in the days, because at the time of the formation of Kievan Rus, so basically the period, the historical period that you are talking about today, which goes from like 500 and then up until 1200, and most prominently from, I guess, 800 and then up and like till 1200, where we really see like the expansion and the flourishment of Kievan Rus. In the exact same period, we also see the expansion and the flourishment of the old Frankish Empire. And I know that the borders of these two countries or empires, it's always a bit, how can you say it? It's pretty difficult to pick the correct terms for describing what was earlier state formations, but at least the state that was France and the state that was Kievan Rus, they somehow had a connection and an alignment, like they were allies in that period. And I think that maybe 100%. This is what Macron... 100%. Mm, and it's, as you also have to be... so I cannot speak for Macron. I cannot say that, oh, this is definitely the thing that Macron now draws upon as the reason for why he is saying the things that he is now, because there's also like current geopolitical realities which suggest that he should do that. But it just speaks volume to this connection, this ancient connection between France and Ukraine. And when I was thinking about it, I was actually more thinking about it in lines of, okay, so all these European leaders, you have former British leader mainly, Boris Johnson, you've had Olaf Scholz, Danish leaders, Scandinavian leaders, and so on. I think they all have historical connections to Ukraine somehow that binds our states with the state of Ukraine and like binds our people together as well. And in that case, I just think that this goes to show that this connection is also there between France and Ukraine. And maybe this one historically is even stronger than the bonds between Ukraine and Britain and Ukraine and the Scandinavian countries. But like in a broad perspective, for me, it just goes to show that this historical connection between Ukraine and European countries is not just something that we have invented for the like, because it is political opportune or something like that. It's just historical facts. And I think in a twisted way, like, this is also very abstract, but maybe that's just how history is, that France and Ukraine back in the days had an alignment, and now they have it again, and that just goes to show this thing about history going in spirals as well and so on. So I think it's a very interesting connection. That got a bit long. I'm sorry.
No, it's totally fine. Moreover, you're absolutely right. And further, you will see the connections not only with France, but with other European back then states who are states till now. And Yaroslav the Wise was not named the Wise for no reason. He was named the Wise also because of his smart political moves and geopolitical moves, if you can talk about geopolitics in the 10th century. And his legacy extended way beyond his daughter Anna. For example, his beloved son Vsevolod Yaroslavovich further cemented alliances through marriage. In the year of 1046, Vsevolod was wed to Maria, the daughter of Emperor Konstantin Monomakh, strengthening ties between Kievan Rus and Byzantine Empire. And from this union, Vladimir Monomakh, a figure of great importance in Rus history, was born, carrying forward the legacy of his predecessors. Also, Yaroslav had many other daughters. They played pivotal role in European politics and diplomacy. Yelizaveta Yaroslavovna was Queen of Norway, when she married King Harald III. And later she became the wife of King Svein II of Denmark. So at some point she became the queen of both Norway and Denmark, strengthening again the connection with Scandinavian world. While Anastasia Yaroslavovna, known as Edmunda, became a queen of Hungary through her marriage to King Andras I, contributing to the ties between Kievan Rus and Hungarian kingdom. Additionally, Agatha of Kiev, another daughter of Yaroslav, became the wife of the English king Edward the Exile, further illustrating Yaroslav's strategic foresight in fostering alliances across Europe. Through Yaroslav's strategic marriage policy, Kievan Rus expanded its influence and forged enduring bonds with neighboring kingdoms and empires. The marriages of his children not only solidified political alliances, but also cultural exchange and cooperation, leaving the undeniable mark on the history of Europe. However, Yaroslav the Wise was famous not only for his strategic marriage policy. During his rule, a national evolution took place in Kiev state. As I said before, the Varagian influence remained only in the circle of military, while the statesmen were recruited mostly from local people, signifying the start of national story inside of the Kievan Rus history, Ukrainian national story. Also, it's important to notice that the population of Kiev at the time reached 50,000 people. Just for a quick comparison, I actually checked it, one of the biggest cities of Europe at that time was London, counting around 25,000 people, Paris, counting around 20,000 people, Rome, 30,000, and Venice, about 45,000. So as we can see, Kiev was quite a huge entity back then, and basically bigger than the biggest cities of Europe at the time. Also, Yaroslav the Wise was very known for his policy of enlarging Kiev and urbanistically constructing it, like visionary constructing the future big capital. He built the Golden Gate, which became a ceremonial entrance to Kiev, and the restored Golden Gate is still standing in the center, being very famous both touristic and local attraction. A very nice neighborhood, Golden Gate, all Kievan people know it, with the best coffee in the world. In the year of 1037, he finished the construction of the St. Sophia Cathedral on the site of the bloody battle with Pechenegs, being one of the ethnical groups which were in contrary to Kievan Rus a year before. And St. Sophia Cathedral is still standing for almost 1,000 years in the heart of Kiev, and currently it's under UNESCO protection. Also, during the rule of Yaroslav the Wise, Kiev became a trade center not only for Kievan Rus, but for all Eastern European region. And there were 8 markets in the city, which was quite a lot at the time. Basically, Yaroslav the Wise made Kiev a rival of Constantinople. Another critical aspect of this part is the baptismal Rus, because it was central to the cultural flourishing of Kievan Rus. In the year of 988, the Grand Prince Vladimir the Great made a momentous decision to embrace Christianity, paving the way for the conversion for his people. Influenced by Byzantine missionaries and the grandeur of Constantinople, Kievan Rus embarked a spiritual journey that would shape its identity for centuries to come. The baptismal Rus not only transformed the religious landscape, but also opened the door to Byzantine culture, art, philosophy, leaving an incredible mark on the fabric of Ukrainian society. And last but not least, I would love to mention Queen Olga, which is my favorite, personal favorite historical figure, I guess, of all times. Because Queen Olga was a figure of strength and cunning, and she left an incredible mark on the history of Kievan Rus. Following the death of her husband, Prince Igor, at the hands of Drevlyans, Olga embarked on a quest for vengeance, that would become legendary and a very famous story of her three revenges. And long story short, she did succeed. She did succeed and she did kill them all and burn them all as a vengeance for the death of her husband. But her cunning diplomacy and strategic maneuvers caught the attention of Byzantine Emperor Constantine VII, who sought to forge an alliance with powerful Queen of Rus. Olga's interaction with Byzantine court not only elevated her status, but also opened avenues for cultural exchange and cooperation between the two great civilizations. However, her story with Byzantine Emperor was not that simple, because initially he wanted to marry her. So she didn't want this marriage, and she insisted that they couldn't marry because he's pagan and he's Christian, and she asked him to baptize her. However, when he did, he became her godfather, and this fact was used to deny the undeniable marriage again, undesirable marriage again. So I see Queen Olga as the true feminist icon of medieval times.
I definitely agree, and I was also very struck by this when I read the notes that she did this deception of the Byzantine emperor. It must have taken quite a character to do something like that to, a character like the Byzantine emperor. I think because I want to sum up a bit shortly, but can you maybe first elaborate a bit about this Christianization of Kievan Rus? Because I think maybe of all the things that you have spoken about, maybe this is where we lag a bit, because it was, of course, Vladimir the Great, as you also wrote in your notes. But can you just elaborate a bit about this Christianization? Because you also say that the Byzantine emperor baptized the queen of Kievan Rus. So I guess she wasn't baptized before, but can you just explain that story so that everyone will, to the best of your abilities?
Yeah, it's quite hard to explain because it was quite an unlinear process. You can imagine that the territory, there was a huge territory which encompassed a lot of different tribes, nations, ethnicities. And they were all pagans, all with their own exact beliefs, pagan beliefs. And it's impossible to do it in a day, to come and say, no, you're Christians. Christianity was a new thing back then. No one knew the influence, the impact, the strategic changes that Christianity will bring with it. No one but Vladimir the Great, because he had this visionary strategic view on Christianity, and he did this. He made this step himself. He baptized himself, paving the way for the citizens to do it. However, it's very interesting how Orthodox Christianity was evolving again, because people were pagans before. Orthodox Christianity has to do a lot to do with pagan beliefs. For example, just last week, the week of 11th and 17th of March, we celebrate Maslena. Maslena was a pagan. Maslena is like a pre-Eastern celebration, praying for a good harvest, for great spring, a lot of rains, good soil, and yada, yada, yada. Maslena is absolutely a pagan holiday, which evolved into Christianity. The same as Easter originally was a pagan holiday, which just found a mirroring in Christianity. So those two processes were not linear. This process was not linear, and they were very closely intertwined, the paganism and the early Christianity on the territory of Kievan Rus.
All right. That was great. Let me just try to sum up all the things, because you also wrote that a segment is the Russian misinformation, and I think we should get to that shortly. But the story of Kievan Rus of Kiev, in very broad terms can be summed up maybe like this, so that sometime in the 500, like in the year, in the 5th century, Varangians starts coming to the area of Kiev, and then in 482, the Varangians, right, so the like the Vikings, they established the city of Kiev with the local inhabitants as well, so like with the local communities as well. Yeah, you have an objection here, or?
Yeah. They didn't establish the city. The city was there before.
Okay. Sorry. Yeah.
Some organizational structure there, let us say so.
Yeah. So when they came
back in them.
So the city was already there when the Varangians came to Kievan Rus, and then they, with their knowledge about governance, state creation, and so on, created the like Kievan Rus in 400 years later. So that was obviously a very long period, but Kievan Rus was then created in 882, and then 100 years approximately after that, you have Volodymyr the Great, who in 988 AD gets himself baptized, therefore paving the way for the like Christianization of the whole population, which is something I guess you can say that the Queen Olga also promotes when she was then baptized by the Byzantine Emperor. And then after that, you have Yaroslav the Wise and the whole expansion of like Kievan Rus' influence by this strategic marriage policy and so on. And then, yeah, and then the next time, maybe this is a good time to say that. Then the next time we will talk about like the destruction of Kievan Rus, which came with the Mongol invasion. So it has a very like abrupt end, I guess you can say. Is that true?
It's true, and I forgot about one important thing, being that we were talking about Volodymyr the Great. And Volodymyr the Great first introduced his coat of arms, which looked almost identically similar to Trizub, a modern coat of arms of Ukrainian state. This was put as a coat of arms by Volodymyr the Great back in the 10th century. So this symbol traces back to Volodymyr the Great. And now...
That's very important.
State symbol of Ukraine. It's not invented. Mm. It's not a new thing. It's more than 1,000 years old. And I even have a tattoo with it.
Ah, nice.
Yeah.
I have a
Trizub here.
Yeah, actually, I have some like emblems I got when I was in Ukraine, which also depicts that symbol. So that's quite interesting. Anyways, I think with all this said, I think maybe the biggest takeaway for me about Kievan Rus is how big a state it was, how wide it influenced spread. And yeah, so basically it's just the grandeur, I guess you can say, of Kievan Rus is maybe what has struck me the most after you were talking about it, and also like reading your notes. Then maybe it's also relevant, I guess, to place it in like broader context, which you have been talking a lot about as well. But it was at a time where the Byzantine empire was very strong as well. You had the Franks, and then you had obviously like a luring threat in the east, which was the Mongol Empire as well. So that are like the four main actors, I guess you can say, contributing to the development of like Ukrainian history in that period. Obviously, the formation of Kievan Rus being the biggest, importance here. But yeah, time is really like catching up on us, and we want to keep it around an hour. But Can you just, before we move on to like some quick questions, elaborate on this whole Russian misinformation thing? And we have already talked a bit about it, so maybe it doesn't have to be like that long.
Yeah, okay, I would start from Novgorod, because Russian propaganda always narrates Novgorod as an important part of Kiev and Rus. And because Novgorod is on the territory of Russia, they say that that was the center of Kiev and Rus. It was at some point a very important city and even a capital of Kiev and Rus. However, if we take the word Novgorod itself and translate it to any of Slavic language, we would have the root Nov, coming from Novi, meaning new, and Gorod, meaning city or town. So Novgorod, in its name itself, is the new city, meaning Kiev as an old city, and Novgorod as a new one. That's where Putin propaganda just breaks down, because it makes no sense. And if we ask, okay, if Kiev and Rus is Ukraine, what was Russia? And you just now said about Mongol Empire. The majority, 99, I will not talk numbers, but the majority of the territory of Russia was under Mongol Empire for all this time, up to the foundation of Novgorod and subsequently the activities on that territory. And again, it started as a civilization only with Kiev and Rus. So here we can put a question. Maybe it's Russian civilization that emerged from Ukrainian one, not vice versa. Yeah, basically, you know, throughout what we were talking about, we can see that Ukraine has a long-lasting European history with a lot of ties, major European countries, major European processes. Again, we stress out the importance of rule of law, the importance of codification of life, of rules that were applied to peasants, that were applied to the towners, that were applied to the citizens of the big cities, the trade with Baltics, the trade with Islamic world, with Turks. All of this is what Kiev and Rus encompassed back then, while Russia was just a part of Mongol Empire, basically without any organizational structure, any rule of law, any important like trade actions.
Yeah, sorry, it's just because we just go on, Lisa, yeah, because I know you have Moya, so just go on. Yeah,
I just wanted to finish that despite the challenges posed by Russian propaganda, Ukraine remains resilient in its embrace of Kiev and Rus as a cornerstone of its culture and historical identity. By celebrating the achievements of Kiev and Rus and highlighting the significance of European civilization, we are reclaiming our heritage and forging connections with the broader European community. Kiev and Rus serves as a testament to Ukraine's enduring legacy and its integral role in shaping the cultural tapestry of Europe. By embracing Kiev and Rus as a part of its national and European heritage, Ukraine reaffirms its sovereignty and strengthens its bonds with the wider European family. And I guess that's the most important point that I wanted to make with this episode, talking about Kiev.
And thanks a lot for stressing this point also here in the end about Kiev and Rus period.
Kiev was not ruled by Moscow. They were not part of the same political entity. For centuries, Kiev was looking westwards.
Now, I think we have a little time left, and I've prepared these like quick questions. And as we have talked about, we want to like have some repeating subjects, some themes that comes up in all the episodes, and like are some themes that plays a huge part in Ukrainian history and also in the informational war about Ukrainian history. And also, some of them are also like put in there because it makes a connection to like between Ukrainian history and the war today. So I think the first one, and yeah, I'm sorry, but you, I guess I just have to say you need to answer as short as possible, but like no stress. It doesn't, it's not a problem that it gets a bit longer. But the first one is this one about geography. And today, a lot of geography and territories were covered. But what do you see as the most clear relation between the territories covered today and the war today?
Yeah, I would say that the territory of Kievan Rus majorly encompasses the territory of Ukraine in almost in its entirety. I mean, talking about modern Ukraine, whether when we talk about Russia, not that much, only small part, and only in the part of Kievan Rus history. So I guess that would be the connection.
Yeah, that's very important, I think, because then I guess this is probably the only time in Ukrainian history where you can point at something which was a state based upon Kievan Ukrainian roots that covered all of what is today internationally recognized Ukraine. So yeah, that is a very interesting fact.
And you know, it's a very, very popular saying inside of Russia that Kyiv is a mother of Ruskich cities. But again, when they say Ruskich, they mean Russian. When we say Ruskich, we mean from Rus. That's what we discussed in the beginning.
But you mean the actual Rus
inside of Russia. Yes, yes. Almost any Russian you ask, they will know this saying that Kyiv is a mother of Ruskich cities. But they just misinterpret the name.
Sure. And now moving on to the second one, which is this colonial perspective. And there's already been a lot about that today. But in a certain way, we are still talking about a point of history where Ukraine has not fallen under the control of an external occupier yet. But how would you relate today's topic to that of Ukraine as having historically been the victim of external imperial control?
Yeah, I guess I uncovered this already, saying that they stole the heritage of Kievan Rus and claimed it as Russian to justify Russia being the entity, imperial entity it is. I guess the main imperial discourse lays just here.
So instead of this being a period where Ukraine was, as the like events played out, under control of another empire, i.e. the Russians, because that's whom it were the most. But instead, in this case, it's not stealing of land or stealing of resources, but it's stealing a cultural heritage, and like it is basically stealing the origin
and succession. And succession.
It says a lot about Russia as well.
And this concept, we'll talk about it in later episode, but this concept evolved during the Moscovia became Russian Empire, and to justify this imperialistic way of being, they needed history to prove it, why they can claim it.
I actually have and I have just a point about this, because the first time that I ever stumbled upon the name Kievan Rus was when I read it in that famous Putin essay from the summer of 2021. So I was already like prematurely, I knew, of course, all right, I'm going to read some sort of distorted version of history, so I cannot use this for anything else than analyzing what Putin might think. But still, the fact that this was the first time I stumbled upon the name Kievan Rus just goes to show that the fact that Putin put it in there means that a lot of people interested in the war in Ukraine, in Russia, in history, they will have read about Kievan Rus for the first time with Putin as the center of the message article or whatever you can call it. And that's a problem because this makes it so that he has had the opportunity to be the first one to somehow imprint the narrative about Kievan Rus in the minds of Europeans, Westerners, and like people all around the world. And that's actually not that nice to think about when I say it like that. Therefore, our project is just all the more important. But let's move on to the third question, and that is this point we also talked about initially about the continuation of Ukrainian history. And then I guess you can say, what is the historical connection between Kievan Rus and the period of Ukrainian history that Ukraine finds itself in today?
In the face of relentless propaganda, we as Ukraine embarked on a courageous struggle for a narrative of our sovereignty, seeking to cover this misinformation that you mentioned, especially Putin's misinformation. But it can be only done through scholarly research, historical analysis, public advocacy, what we are doing right now, and reclaiming the narrative of Kievan Rus being the rightful predecessor of Ukraine, not Russia, and focusing on, again, facts, historical sources, proven, things that can be proven. Linking us
so,
with our history.
Yeah, so in this way, the story of Kievan Rus is linked to the story of Ukraine today a lot.
It
because
is the story of Ukraine,
yes. Exactly, yeah, and the story of Ukraine today is also very much a story about claiming the historical past of Ukraine. And in the effort to make this claim, the origin story, Kievan Rus, is a huge part of what is happening today, I guess, in Ukraine and in academic circles, scholars, and so on. Would you say that actually? Okay, so let's wind back to before the full scale invasion. My sense is that not as many Ukrainians would be as would have the same historical knowledge that they have today about Kievan Rus and so on. Do you think that's a correct assessment? Has this historical interest also really emerged in Ukraine among Ukrainians and so on since the full-scale invasion?
Of course, events like war, they mobilize national identity and the interest, the spark of interest to one's culture and traditions, because when someone conducts a genocidal war against your country, you come back to your roots. That's a very natural process of accelerating the interest. But to be honest, from my experience, this is a well-known, widespread information that absolutely every person who went to school in Ukraine knows. And every Ukrainian knows that Kievan Rus is the beginning of Ukrainian national history. So I would not say that it was not well-known or we didn't see the connection between Kievan Rus and Ukraine, and modern Ukraine. We all seen it and always seen it as an integral part of our history. It's just that, with war, the national identity is being crystallized and we are understanding who we are and that we have way more connection with Western European world than with so-called Russian world.
And my last question is related to Russian misinformation and so on, but I think we've already talked enough about that today, so I don't really think it's necessary. Instead, I just want to close off now by saying, yeah, thanks a lot to you for presenting this very interesting part of Ukrainian history. And I really look forward to the next time where I will be presenting what happens after Kievan Rus, which is, I guess today actually was a pretty positive period, like a positive subject and like a nice time to talk about as well. And with the next time, it will obviously be with the invasion of Kievan Rus by the Mongol Empire. So that's not as a... That will be a period with a bit more sadness, like bad things happening and so on. Do you have anything you want to say here going out?
I just want to say thank you a lot for initiating the series. It's especially important, the fact that you are a foreigner interested in Ukrainian history. And I guess, again, that builds these bridges between us and Western world, you being the representative of Scandinavian predecessors. We have common predecessors, apparently. But thank you again for this initiative. I am super happy and super honored to participate.
And I guess those were the last words for today then. And then to all the listeners out there, this will be the very last message. Find us on Instagram, find us on other social media as well. There will be links to everyone in the team in the description of the episode. And then, if you see our post stories and so on, I would just like to say like, follow and share. Let's get the story of Ukraine out everywhere. So that's a slogan as well I've been thinking about. But that was the last thing for today. So, hey, that was it from this week's episode. I really hope you guys enjoyed it and that you will follow along as we make our way throughout Ukrainian history. Besides that, I want to encourage everyone to find us on social media. There are links in the description. On social media, we will also post some videos and make some reels to make all this a bit more interactive and easier to follow for you guys as well. So if you find us there and see the videos and reels, please also share on your own social media platforms. It's in that way that we spread out the history of Ukraine to as many people as possible. Slava Ukraini!